That was
years of course confusion.
Oh, fascist moron.
Well, hello everyone. I'm here. It's taken me about 10 days to get over this bloody cold, but I think today is finally the end of it. I'm still a little bit bunged up, but it's taken a while, I have to say. Anyway, you know that intro? I am convinced that Peter Hitchens says at the start of it, you know, when you're going through the different corridors, I'm convinced that Peter Hitchens says he's a fascist moron like that. I need confirmation from the guy who made it. But what is it that Peter Hitchens says? It sounds like he says he's a fascist moron like that. So anyway, so let us begin. We're going to be talking about. I've already got stick from Aaron McIntyre for the sloptastic thumbnail and title to this. But I do actually want to talk about what Tim Pool said, because I think there's some really interesting, what do the leftists call it? Learning opportunities, learning moments. Is that what they call it? There's a few pretty interesting things to talk about. Management, managerialism, mass scale, entrepreneurship. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in what Tim Pool is moaning about in his kind of drama quit. But anyway, before we get going, I'll just remind everybody, do buy a course at the academic agency. Buy it now. You need to get foundations of research that will kickstart your ability to become a world expert in any topic in the space of like a week, basically, if you follow those principles. Trivium, entrepreneurship, which we're going to be talking about, economics. I did a old school economics video earlier on. All of the great courses are available. Buy it now, ladies and gentlemen. And let's hit an advert.
Are you sick of hearing about Marx and Keynes? Do you want to know why neoclassical economics is so flawed? Have you ever wondered how to work out the marginal productivity of a burger bun? Do you want to level up your econ knowledge? Buy it now. £350. Foundations of Economics. Foundations of Economics.
I'm here.
Foundations of Economics. Get it now.
So somebody in the chat is saying, research, is that Google? Well, it turns out it's not actually just Google. Since I've been ill, and in fact, I was so ill, I was stuck in bed for a couple of days, I've really got into Hammer Horror. I had this idea I was going to do something on Hammer Horror for Halloween. But you know what I'm like. I get obsessive. I fall down rabbit holes. And, well, the whole thing has ballooned. And I'm going to be ending up making a Hammer Horror kind of definitive guide along the lines of my Carry On ones and the Batman one I did back in the day. I've got a video about how to get into Batman comics somewhere in the back catalogue. Every once in a while, I kind of do this. Well, it'd be like, well, what is research for something like Hammer Horror? And, you know, a normal person might just Google it. But if you just Google Hammer Horror, you'll come up with a ton of slop. You'll come up with what films, top 10 list, or Entertainment Weekly, or some bullshit. You know, at the very best, you'll get, you know, a couple of guides from the British Film Institute. But of course, if you're me, you want to know the insides and outs. Not just who the team were, but how it worked. What were the nuts and bolts mechanics? What were the economics behind the studio? What, you know, what made it tick? Why did it succeed? Why did it fail? And in order to do that, you can't just rely on Google. you have to consult actual books, and I've consulted many actual books already. For example, I have consulted a book called Hammer and Beyond, the British horror film by Johnny Walker, the complete Hammer film story, the Hammer Films Elstree Studio Years by Wayne Kinsey. I have consulted The Complete Hammer by Howard Maxford. I have consulted the official Hammer story that came out. But that wasn't enough. You see, that's still level one research. That was just kind of a surface survey. You need to go deeper because, you know, pretty much anybody can do that. So you need to go more. So then I found a book called The Fox That Got Away, which publishes box office receipts from Fox, who were the distributors of Hammer in America between the years of 1966 and 1970. So then I could get an overview of how much these films were making, what their budgets were, and so on and so forth. But still, it's not enough. So then I went to look up what academics had been writing about these I found a paper called Hammering Out a Deal, The Contractual and Commercial Context of The Curse of Frankenstein and Dracula by Vincent L. Barnett, published in 2013. That was in a journal. It was in the Historical Journal of Film, Radio and Television, which goes through the contracts in tedious detail. And then I was starting to pull together, well, yes, now I actually understand how it works, and I could think about then how to break down that information and share it then with my own audience, which is all of you guys. This is kind of, you know, more than normal research. I also did a panoramic sweep of all of the Hammer Horror Top Tens on YouTube. I consulted a buddy of mine who should be coming on, hopefully, as well, on their favorite Hammer movies. I watched a 10-hour documentary series by a Hammer horror nerd called Crab Apple, and various other documentaries. So, you know, I mean, granted, I was ill, so I had more time than usual, and I was stuck in bed, so I had, you know, time to do all of this stuff. But I'm just saying that there's research, and then there's research. Just a Google search, not going to get you there. Anyway. Let us get on to the meat of the show. Well, I'll talk about Tim Pool in a second before I get to the questions. But it's time for our weekly shareholder meeting, friends. I promised I would every week. I would let you know how the revamp era is going, as if you were a group of shareholders with a kind of stake in how things are going. And well, here is. The current data. Publishing more helped your channel get 101% more views than usual. Your channel got 917,100 views, more than the 411,000 to 500,000 it usually gets in 28 days. So there we've got a pretty fair comparison between the revamp era and the old era, where I was doing Unpopular Opinions and Cigar Stream every week. You can see that the revamp era has definitely worked. And in terms of views, you can see it there, 404,000 more than usual, pretty much doubled, more than doubled the views. Watch time is up, just about up. Don't forget, I was doing 9 hours a week before, and subscribers are up, new subscribers, that is. There's been 3,000 of them in the past month. And if you're one of those new subscribers and you're wanting to know a bit more about this channel, I encourage you to check out the back catalogue. But there's more. Here are the overall stats from the start of the revamp era. I'm adding to this every week, of course. And we're just hitting over 1 million views since the start of since the start of the revamp. Now, if you notice, these numbers are going up, and let me talk you through how Sir Alex Ferguson, aka me, is making adjustments on the fly. So I started out with this basic structure of the Monday to the Friday, Monday books, Tuesday British, Wednesday American, Thursday international, Friday culture. That's my basic structure, okay? And then I started to, then I did the revamps of the thumbnails and the texture teal. But then I started the rank opportunism of stuff like the James Lindsay video and the kissing stuff. You know, you got to make space. You got to create opportunities. And, you know, if I've got the, if I know those five videos are coming, why not pike in with a sneaky 10 or 20 minute video, like a goal poacher, basically, you know? But really the thing that has, I have noticed is that if you have a look in the early part, these very topical videos like Trump on the Haitians, Puff Daddy, even Badenoch stuff there, wasn't getting over as much as the book ones on the left here. You can see the book ones have been very strong. Apart from the Blair one, the book ones have been strong. And, you know, a few other ones have been strong, right? So what was it? What was it that was getting over about these ones that these ones weren't getting over? And here's what I thought. Well, I think the general audience doesn't want rank kind of current news cycle slop, which is what some of these stories were. So last week I experimented with pushing all of the stuff to being much more general, much more kind of 10,000 foot level stuff. Like, you know, what if America was a one party state? Why won't progressive neoliberalism die? The roots of feminism in Soviet Russia, things like that, which are basically what you call in YouTube world, evergreen. Facebook was evergreen as well. The one world government was evergreen. And so this is what I'm thinking now, is that the middle weeks were sagging. The middle Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday have been not getting over as much because they're too kind of news cycle, too close to the news cycle for the general viewership. That's my current thinking, but we'll see how that goes as time comes. I mean, I've also noticed that the two videos that have done well here on James Lindsay and Snake Kissing have been, broadly speaking, stuff about other people in the space, which is why I kind of mocked that by putting Tim Pool quits in the title line here. And I find that I find it kind of interesting that people, no matter what they say, their revealed preference as opposed to stated preference. The stated preference of all people is, oh, we don't like drama. We hate drama. The revealed preference is, ooh, what's AA going to say about Konstantin Kissin? Or, ooh, what's he going to say about James Lindsay? Or, ooh, what's he going to say about Tim Pool? You feckless sods, you utter disgusting. But this is human nature, I'm afraid. This is human nature. So, yes, I will, in my rank opportunism stream, I'll be eyeing up opportunities to score quick and easy goals in that manner. Anyway, that's the roundup. That's the AGM, as it were. So let us now talk about Tim Pool. And I'm going to play this video that has been put together of Tim Pool complaining and ostensibly, by the looks of things, quitting his own show in quite a petulant manner. So let's have a look at this. But I'm not just going to kind of dunk on Tim Pool here. I actually think there are some really interesting things in what he's saying. And like I was saying earlier on, some learning, what do they call it? It's not learning moments. What a leftist, what did they used to say? Teachable. It's a teachable moment. All right, let's do this.
But yeah, I think this might be the end. We are well off. It is not a financial thing. We make a lot of money. But piece by piece, the structure becomes bigger and bigger and bigger until it becomes impossible to manage. You know, I would never call out anybody personally or individually. I would just say that, like, compounding, laziness.
Yeah.
Yeah. That builds up over time, which adds more and more workload to, you know, me and Allison to get to the point where we're just like, can't do it. We do really well. And, you know, it just, the problem is, without a proper CEO who isn't hosting the show, it's not possible. Like, I think we have like 30 something employees. And so, you know, the conversations I've had with family is like, I am under no illusions that I have the capability to make this company what it could be.
No, this is actually really interesting to me here, because what Tim Pool is saying is that he needs a managerial structure. He actually needs the skills of managerialism. This is something actually that Robert Michels talks about in Political Parties, that the iron law of oligarchy is such that eventually you need people with key technical skills in key positions in order to maintain an organizational structure, which especially comes with mass and scale. This is also discussed by James Burnham, of course, and later by Samuel T. Francis in Leviathan and Its Enemies. Something that I've talked about in the past, and something that has been particularly stressed by my good buddies, Scrump and Evelyn, who I know are not always popular with lots of people, but, you know, it is what it is, that those are the two people who consistently understand the ideas that I talk about here and develop them, you know, in ways that are basically true and, you know, I mean, less said about their personal diplomacy, the better, I guess. They can rub people up the wrong way. But I always have time for those two because they truly understand this stuff I'm about to talk about here. So Tim Pool is saying, like, I need a CEO. I need a kind of organizational structure that's going to get the best out of my staff. Okay. And I mean, this is interesting because in this basic problem that Tim Pool is facing here is actually the birth of a lot of the issues that we have with government and bureaucracy. Because you can see there's a genuine problem here that Tim Pool needs to fix. But then as soon as you start doing it, you get the birth of basically the HR function. You know, my mate Binary Surfer would be the first to tell you that HR, human relations, is not simply a waste of time and resources, but it actually does fulfill a function within any organizational structure that is required, right? For example, it's difficult to hire staff. For most people, it's difficult to find the right person for the job. HR fulfills that function. It's difficult to keep all of the staff motivated with relevant KPIs and targets. HR is meant to cover that function. But then the problem is, once you've got something like HR in there, how do you stop it ballooning and going beyond its original remit? How do you stop the management structure taking over and sapping the life out of what the thing was meant to be about in the first place? Because so often what happens with managerialism is that you get this bit of institutional capture somewhere, and all of a sudden the thing that made the thing great in the first place, let's pretend that the thing that made Tim Pool great was his political insight, let's say, or his reaction to the news cycle or something. This is what made people watch Tim Pool in the first place, right? His serving up of political insights. Let's just pretend it's that. You get this management function in there, and all of a sudden, the Tim Pool show will become about something else, something that didn't bring people to the dance, right? Maybe the Tim Pool show will, you know, turn around to be, you know, some other thing. Tim Pool talking to rappers or something, right? Or like Walt Disney. The Walt Disney studio was about promoting animation, innovating in animation, making motion picture films that had never been made before, things like that. That was the core mission of Disney. But, you know, we've seen over time, the core mission of Disney has been about, like, pushing alphabet spaghetti propaganda, bloody race communism, DEI, feminism, and all the rest of it. So you see what happens when you allow this little node of managerialism in. But then the question is, how do you stop it happening in the first place? Because clearly, when you get to a certain size, typically they say it's about 100 employees. Pool seems to be getting there with 30 employees, but about 100 employees is typically when this happens. So the point I'm making is that this is something that all organizations, it's a moment that they all suffer. You can't run it as a family business anymore. You can't keep it going as just one guy, just one entrepreneur. The size of the thing is too big now. But then it gets away from what it was all about in the first place. So, and many companies, I never make that transition. I'll be talking about Hammer Horror next week. Arguably, one of the things that Hammer Horror was never able to do was to level up from that kind of family structure to becoming corporate. It never became corporate. It always maintained its family identity. But that meant that the studio was over-reliant on key personnel. It was over-reliant on the entrepreneurial talent of James Carreras. It was over-reliant on the production talent of Anthony Hines. It was over-reliant on Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, and they didn't develop new stars. And in the same way, Tim Pool is basically complaining here that the Tim Pool show is, surprise, surprise, over-reliant on Tim Pool. And Tim Pool basically wants to be an in-front-of-the-camera piece of talent. He wants somebody else to take over the management functions. And I find this absolutely fascinating. So you see, friends, the iron fist in the velvet glove. The velvet glove was, ooh, AA is going to talk about Tim Pool. It's going to be drama. But the iron fist is, there's an actual real political and economical lesson in here. Hurrah! Let's carry on.
It's and I hear all these things. No, Tim, you're wrong. You're wrong. Oh, come on. We've been trying to get a coffee shop open for 2 years. Yeah. Clearly, I cannot do it. I skateboard every day. Yeah, if we can't make cameras and a computer work, and despite all the previous failures we've had, there's not a single person here who can make sure that either the studio is operating or secondary studio is operating, we've gotten to a point in the company where everyone's kind of just kicked their feet up and said, I'm doing what I need to be doing. Yeah. And then that just means I'm Sisyphus pushing the rock up. The problem is people are sitting on the rock. We have this awesome property. We have.
I mean, what he's saying there, his employees are not motivated. They don't have a get up and go factor. There is a Pareto distribution in who does the work. He feels like he's doing a lot of it. I bet you anything within the Tim Pool enterprise, there's a few other people who do a lot of the work. It sounds like that woman he hangs out with does a lot of work as well, which is rare, by the way, for a woman to be the Pareto 20%, right? But this is basically what he's struggling with. How do you get up? How do you get slugs, the 80% non-Pareto slugs, to be up and motivated and so on and so forth, and this is difficult. And I mean, I'll be honest. I have always liked to operate as a one man thing. I mean, okay, I've brought on guests and so on, but in terms of the basics, I don't like to delegate, which actually is something that hampers growth. You know, I was sharing the shareholder meeting stuff. You know, really what I should have done years ago is hired a couple of researchers, to help me out to kick, so I could kick on and make it more of a production cycle. I could do like 3 videos a day, say. Trouble is, I know that as soon as you start bringing other people into the project, all of this bullshit starts. Okay, I mean, this is obviously a scale, but you get a load of other problems, management issues. I know I can rely on myself. I know that if I want to, I can bang out, you know, I can get a lot of work done in a short amount of time, and I know it will be of a high standard, my own standard. Okay, I know that if I hired some 18, 19, 20 year old, they may even start well, but after a couple of weeks, I'd be having to prod them and do all that management stuff, which then creates the need for a second function, a manager, right? A manager who's basically there to prod other people to get stuff done. And lo and behold, now the whole thing is about something other than what you set out to do in the first place. So when you're getting to the point where you're prodding somebody else to do something, you're getting away from the core mission, which in my case is making quality content, right? Let's pretend that's my core mission, is to make quality content that will actually educate people or give somebody a different way of thinking about something, okay? Well, you can't, all of a sudden you're away from that now if basically what the enterprise is about is a manager prodding a 20-year-old to try to do something, right? I mean, it's like, well, you've got away from what the thing was about in the first place. And I don't actually have an answer to this, because this is a tale as old as time. This is basically the kind of $64 million question at the heart of how do we solve the competency crisis? Okay, because there is nothing that actually stops this process, what I'm talking about. And it has been the Achilles heel of quote unquote capitalism, because it doesn't know how to deal with mass and scale. How do you keep the Ford Motor Company dynamic and strong and innovative with the loss of Henry Ford and the bringing in of these managers? And I would argue that Ford Motor Company ceased to be those things when the old man died and when it was taken over by the forces of managerialism. This is what some Tory types call the blob, quote unquote. So anyway, let's carry on.
Skate parks. We have Willy Wonka's candy factory or whatever, yeah. Chocolate factory. Why can't we get people to just do something? Again, like not calling anybody. I don't want to insult anyone directly, but it's just seeing someone stand around, do nothing. And then so the challenge is, in order to make this show operate, I have to work what is effectively 16 hours a day. So like I haven't had weekday sunset in 4 years, you know, like just through the window or something, or now that we're in the new studio, there's no windows at all. Wow, what if I finished work at a normal time like everybody else and just, I don't know, hopped in the car and went down to the...
I mean, this bit is a bit self-indulgent. He's basically saying like, I'm an entrepreneur. I have to work really long hours. I really put the hours in and, you know, why? You know, I never see the daylight. Okay, well, guess what, Tim? A lot of us have to work long hours. That's just a bit of self-indulgence. What a leftist would say here, or what a lot of you might be thinking, is, well, hold on a second, Tim. You're the top man. Presumably, you're remunerated a lot better than some of your team are there, right? The guy who he's struggling to motivate is probably on a fraction of what Tim Pool is on. I would say the ratio is probably like 1 to 100 or something. I don't know the wage rates of Tim Pool minions, but I mean, let's face it. Some of those people were probably on below, if I had to guess, they'd be on like 30 grand or something, 40 grand. And Tim Pool, I'd imagine, is on what, 10 times that, 20 times that? I mean, I don't know. So it's a bit rich to say, well, oh, you know, I work really long hours. It'd be like, yeah, mate, you're a multimillionaire. And so you kind of got to expect you're going to have to work long hours. The bloody intern who's either not getting paid or is on 20 or 30K or something, you can't expect them to put the same hours in. I don't even think you need to be a leftist to say that. I think a bog standard libertarian would tell you that. This is, you know, basic economics, Tim. But anyway, let's carry on.
river and looked at frogs.
Yeah.
If I show up in the morning and I do my morning show, I get to give a portion of the work that I do to them so that they can try and make something work. And, you know, I know they're trying as hard as they can, and some more successful than others.
People are saying Sargon actually seemed to get this right and has avoided a lot of these issues. Now, I'm buddies with Carl, and I would be surprised if Carl has not faced any of these issues at all. But maybe he's just put a braver face on things. But I would be surprised, because I'm sure in his heart of hearts, Carl knows kind of things were probably easier when he was just one guy doing his own YouTube, right? Because he has complete control over himself, whereas now he's got a big staff. So some of these issues I'm talking about here, I have no doubt that he will have faced. Maybe he's navigated them well. I don't know. I mean, I think Carl has done exceptionally well with the Lotus Eaters, and I carry on wishing them the best of success. But I would be surprised if he hasn't faced any of these issues at all, or if he hasn't had some frustrations with, you know, staff motivation, etc. But again, some of the same dynamics I talked about will also be at play, right? But anyway, let's carry on.
But it just becomes too burdensome, to the point where unless they get off the ground and are able to maintain and manage themselves and make money, we can't do it anymore. There's a degree of staff required to run a show like this, and it's, yeah, I'm going to work 16 hours every single day to the bone and figuratively say I get no weekday sunsets so that someone else can be like, I ain't going to fix it. And
you see, in a way, it's unfortunate that Tim is washing his dirty laundry in public in this way, because it's perfectly possible he could have these feelings, keep them to himself, overcome these challenges within his own organization, and nobody would have known. This is a little bit of emotional immaturity from Tim, I'm afraid. He didn't need to tell thousands, millions of people this, to be honest. Could have just moaned to a friend or something, but he's saying it to everybody, which is highly drama queenish, it has to be said. And again, if you're part of this organization, a lot of people who are part of that organization will be thinking, do I want this guy as a boss? Because this guy is childish, basically. This guy does not have the professionalism to know not to say this sort of stuff in public so that complete strangers like me can comment on it, for example. So I would say this is poor leadership from Tim Poole. And when he said that he needs a CEO, that is probably correct, right? So, you know, one thing he could have done is just like hire a CEO, for example, and not have done this, or hire a COO. If he doesn't want to give up complete control, he could have an operational manager, something like that.
And there are a lot of people here who are willing to do a lot more and go above and beyond. Yeah, Raymond's sitting right here.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I was like, yeah, you should sit in this one. And then there are a lot of people that are like, when can I put the knife in Tim's back? I can keep doing my morning show. There's no issue.
Yeah.
I require zero employees to do that. So I kind of feel like I shouldn't get paid less for, like, so I'll give you some stories. We've had instances of people who work here leaking private information to far leftists who are harassing and stalking us.
Oh, good.
Yeah. We've had instances of people stealing equipment, getting caught on camera.
All right. So, yeah. I mean, if you're running your own company, that is obviously like the thing not to do, right? Especially if you've got employees. That is basically like he's throwing his team under the bus, basically, in public, which is just a terrible thing to do, really. It would be like Carl putting out, like, I mean, people are talking about Sargon. I can't see Carl doing this because he's an honorable man and is a good guy. It'd be like Carl coming on his own big channel with, you know, to his million subs saying, like, oh, the thing is, I fucking hate Harry. You know, Harry is, he's just not putting his weight. You know, I've done what I can. Connor Tomlin's son, he just doesn't put the hours in. You know, it'd be like just like burying all of his staff, you know, and that would just be like, it's just a terrible thing, and it would be a betrayal of all of those people and how all of those people would have felt. Right, I'm just trying to put it in terms with guys we know to try to humanize it, because I don't have a bloody clue who Tim Pool's team are, to be honest, right? Anyway, that is that. Yeah, pretty poor behavior from Tim. But I also thought it was an interesting kind of little thing to look at. So I'm going to have a look now at the Q&A stuff. We're going to have a look at the super thanks first, and then the super chats, of course. So these are all of the super thanks from the past week or so. And there's been quite a few of them this time. Where do we go from? What I learned from Konstantin Kissin's war on free speech. No, I think I did those last time. Neoliberalism, why won't it die? I think I did that one as well. Let's start with this one. What if America was a one-party state? Hope you are well, EA, says Smith Dorian. To what extent do you think that political systems are expressions of their ruling ethnicity? For example, would China be brutally utilitarian, not because it's a one-party state, but rather because it's the Chinese ethnic character to be this way, whereas America's ruling ethnicity seems to value indulging their own material and moral vices at the expense of the country? I think there's some truth to that. Yes, that basically seems to be true. And you do get into some interesting stuff with that. Like Gobineau, for example, argues that the French Revolution was actually an ethnic revolution as well, that the people who enacted the French Revolution were racially different, ethnically different from the old aristocracy. So that's an interesting thing to ponder. How much truth there is to all of that, I'm not sure. He's talking in a spiritual sense, of course, but I'm sure you could have a look at the actual biological fact of it as well. The Chinese, from my reading, have always been quite as they are now. I mean, I've got a book on ancient Chinese civilization here, and I've read people like Lord Shang and various different dynasties, and they've always had a tendency towards, how can I say, a kind of internal insularity. So they're not a very expansive people in terms of looking to conquer other nations, and they've always been big on big government programs, centralization, massive dam building projects and things like that, right back, I'm talking like 1000 BC, 2000 BC, you get these stories of guys like, you know, right, we're going to build like huge dam project over here, or there's going to be a massive canal project over there. So it seems like the Chinese tend towards that sort of way of organizing things. I guess in economics terms, you'd say they've always been rather state interventionist, right? So even before the communist revolution, I mean, I'm trying to think of other examples. I mean, when it comes to the American ruling class, I would say that there are certain ethnic considerations there that are rather difficult to overlook. Valuing their own material and moral vices at the expense of the country is one way of putting it. I would say that there is a kind of moral particularism at the heart of the American ruling class at the moment, which has one set of rules for themselves and a different set of rules for the general population, let's just put it that way, and that their ultimate goals and aims and so on are not necessarily aligned with those of the American nation or the American people. I'll just put it that way. In terms of the British ruling class or the English ruling class, I mean, overlooking the fact that they've been foreign since 1066, of course. Don't forget the Normans are not the original English or Welsh, indeed, or the Scots. They are different people, the Normans who came in. But let's just pretend for a second that the Normans were naturalized in, you know, over the space of 100 or 200 years, and think about British kind of tendencies. I would say that the British tendency has been towards basically a kind of state interventionism as well, in economic terms, really for most of its history. This is particularly brought to bear if you read Frederick List, or you read something like Belloc's Servile State or something like that. There are quite a lot of policies that you describe as protectionist, really. Joseph Schumpeter as well, when he considers that. So I think one of the great misnomers that people have is that the quote-unquote Anglo is a natural kind of free marketeer or a natural libertarian, right? This is often, you know, and then it goes hand in hand with laissez-faire or something like that. I would argue that the natural tendency of the Brit is towards a kind of socialism, if I'm honest, and that has been basically true for all of history that I can tell. That the basic tendency is to be distrustful of what Carlyle would call the cash nexus, and you can see it in Shakespeare. You can see it all across history. Chaucer, that there's a basic distrust of money being the thing that makes the world go round in the Anglo mindset. This, I think, is one of the great smear jobs. And I often, you know, when I see people go on about perfidious Albion and, you know, the Anglo does it again on all these sorts of memes, really there's a very, very small passage in the kind of middle period of the British Empire where, you know, that literally for a space of about 40 years, they adopted laissez-faire. But even if you go back and watch my appearance on Brokenomics with Dan Tubbs, even laissez-faire in the British Empire was basically a form of control. And I explained it all then, you know. You know, you basically force a country like Ghana into cocoa manufacture. You know, oh, you're gonna grow cocoa plant here, and then you're gonna ship that cocoa to a factory, you know, in Birmingham or something. We'll turn it into chocolate bars and sell it back to you in the name of free trade. But of course, it's not free trade. You say, oh yeah, and David Ricardo's comparative advantage. I mean, bollocks! It was they were basically forcing colonies to, you know, turn their arable land into cash crops, in order to manufacture it back in Blighty, so that they had a massive advantage in manufactures, in finished goods. And you do it in the name of specialization under the division of labor or comparative advantage. So it was, I mean, really, the idea of laissez-faire is a mirage, right? And then you say to Belgium, listen, Belgium, if you try to put fucking tariffs against our chocolate made in Birmingham, our Mr. Cadbury's chocolate, if you dare try to stop that, we'll bring the boats in. So you better trade with us. And then you call it free trade. I mean, come on. It's absolute bollocks is what it is. There was never laissez-faire under the British Empire. Absolute bullshit. The only mistake they made, which I talked about before, is some of the ruling class started to believe their own bullshit. And when they repealed the Corn Laws, they allowed basically all, like 90% of agricultural produce to come from imports from America. Huge number of corn imports came from the States. during the 19th century, while the United States maintained massive trade tariffs on imports coming the other way, it was selling into Britain. And that helped build the United States up during the 19th century, so that when the British Empire fell on some tough times in World War One or after World War One, when they had to take out some loans, America was very well placed to take over then. America then repeated the exact same mistake, in my view, with China. Now, America has basically built up China so that as soon as America has a crisis, the American Empire has a crisis, well, the Chinese are well poised to take over. So it's funny how history repeats in that way. Because America at some point started to believe its own bullshit, basically. So anyway, let's carry on. This is the best non-woke books for children. This is Savini Law. I wonder what AA would think of Struwwel Palter, a 1845 German children's book for 3 to 6 year olds. It's a classic. Basically, every German household has a copy of this book. I believe AAA would like it, since she's into grown-up stuff. You can buy the book in English. That sounds really good. I would love to know, like, what is the name of that book? It's called For 3 to 6 year olds. Well, what is the name of that? I'll check it out, because since I made that video, I can see. I've just Googled it now. Der Struwwel. Okay. Oh, I might check that out. I mean, one of the things I've been looking at since I made that video is the classic Ladybird books with the classic art, you know, Elves of the Shoemaker and all of that. I had some of those books when I was a kid, but I can't find them now. And I would love to be able to pick up some of the old Ladybird kind of classic books. But the front cover's a bit scary, though, for a 4-year-old. But anyway, let's have a look. I will see if I can check a source, an English version of that. The copies that are coming up are German, but presumably there's a English translation. Alphonse Rides Again says, so these are all questions now on my Discover the Secrets, the 8 Schools of the Right. That was my video yesterday about the 8 Magic Schools of the Right. Before I get going on that, bloody hell. Give me a second, friends. I need to blow my nose. Oh, right. I need to blow my nose. Let me have a sufficiently long advert and then I'll be back. I'm delighted to be launching the second part of the Trivium, Foundations of Logic. This will help anyone who is regularly in the habit of making arguments, whether at work, for study, for example, in essays, or just in the cut and thrust of everyday life. We are surrounded by arguments. We are surrounded by people making truth claims about the world. And logic gives you the tools to analyze and assess those claims while also ensuring that your own arguments are sharp and on point. And I know a lot of you want that. Foundations of Logic is a very traditional course, drawing chiefly from the tradition of Aristotle, which was inherited and built upon by the medieval scholastic logicians and carried forward. It's a good course now. I forgot how much great stuff there is on Foundations of Logic. Bloody hell, this cold is not clearing up, I tell you. I thought it was gone, but bloody hell. Anyway, where was I? Okay. First thing on the Schools of Magic video, generally a great reaction to that. Lots of people enjoyed it, but too many comments came in with, this is astrology. This is astrology for autists and things like that. Such a pathetic comment. Let me just tell you something. That video on the Schools of the Right is based on years and years of observation from actual verifiable information you could basically give me any figure on the right, and I could tell you immediately which schools they belong to or major in. I mean, it works basically perfectly. So don't give me, this is astrology, blah, 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 blah. Shut up. It's not astrology. It's based on verifiable, empirical information and observation. Coming from a far superior understanding of these topics than you could ever muster, bloke in the comments saying it's astrology for autists. Bugger off. Right, anyway, let me continue. So there are three super thanks on this, and then I will hit the actual super chats for this week. Alphonse Rides Again says, majors in trad include a lot of people who don't engage with who you don't engage with too much. Charles Columbine, classical theist, meaning of Catholic, even Matt Frad. A lot of people in our space major in realism and minor in trad. For example, Distributist, Turnip, Charlemagne, and even Pete Q. I mean, Pete Q at this point is probably majoring in tribe, let's be honest. But I don't know, to be honest. But every time I see Pete Q, he seems to be talking about issues like that. Distributist, in my mind, is a trad. But I could be wrong on that. I mean, he's got a heavy... I mean, all of the people who came out of that kind of space with me 4 or 5 years ago are hardcore realists, all of us are. But Distributist is pretty trad in my view. I mean, he basically chose that path as far as I know. But I could be wrong. I don't always get the chance to check in with all of my buddies these days. But in my mind, he's a trad. I am actually subscribed to a number of trad channels, hardcore Catholic ones. There's this guy who's always having a go at the Pope that I'm subscribed to. His name is, let me have a look at my subscriptions pull list here. And I'll tell you his name if I come across him, because he is. It's called Return to Tradition. That's one channel. That channel is always having a go at the Pope, like all the time. Who else is pretty trad? There was that guy who he seems to have disappeared now. But do you remember there was that guy who was a school teacher at Eton? I've forgotten his name. What was the name of that dude who was the school teacher at Eton? He was pretty trad. He was like giving like tips for how to treat your wife and all that sort of stuff. Who was that? I forgot that guy's name. Will Nolan. Nolan knows, that was it. He was pretty trad. I've got a kind of an idea of trads. To be honest, I kind of went away from that myself, because I mean, I don't know, with all of these, I mean, the thing is, this is true of all of them. After a while, you just keep on going round and round, you know, you keep on making the same points over and over again. There's this guy, Return to Tradition. He's always having a go at Pope Francis and highlighting what cardinals have said and all of that. And in my experience, guys who go kind of down that line get too involved in Vatican politics or the goings on of like church organization. And I mean, let's be honest, I just don't give a shit about any of that sort of stuff. It seems to become what Arnold Toynbee would call too much of the temporal institution, right? It's all about veneration of the temporal institution. And I just can't, Settler's Lament seemed to go that way. I'm like, all right, well, now we're getting like bogged down in what Pope Francis thinks about something. It's like, is this the most important thing on earth right now? So yeah, I was never going to go that way myself. And in fairness, I don't think Dave does that, right? Because Dave is obviously closer to someone like me anyway. So Salad Fork says, interesting to consider the contrast with the left here. I would say that whereas there are several of these different schools of rightism, the left is instead merely a straight line with the differentiation coming merely from how far along that one path they are. I mean, if a leftist was sitting here, he'd say, oh, yeah, but there's a massive difference between a left libertarian and a tanky. You know, Aaron Bastani would want to point out very quickly that there's a big difference between him, for example, and Keir Starmer. So, you know, it really depends on who you ask. I mean, the thing is that not all leftists are wokesters. So I would say woke has created a massive split in the left as well. What about my old buddy, my old nemesis, Lord Keynes too? I mean, he, from a certain point of view, was like a hardcore right winger, but he would put himself on the left. And he puts himself on the left, of course, because he's a Keynesian, right? And he associates with Labour Party and the history of the left and things like that. Or George Galloway, say. I mean, there's all sorts of people on the left. Jeffrey Sachs is a leftist, you know? So I would not kind of say that they're all on a continuum. What they do all have in common is that there's some commitment to equality there on the left, right? Whereas the right is generally not committed to equality, or they see equality as actively bad. That to me, that is the absolute dividing line between left and right. Tomislav Sunik's book makes this point very well. It's called Against Democracy and Equality. Esoteric Elderman says, thanks, AA, great video. I think all the schools may be of some worth. Even Schizo gives some particularly good early calls, and Slop can be a gateway for some to deeper stuff. Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't have included Schizo and Slop if I thought they were completely worthless, right? Like I've said before, I like Dr. Steve Turley. I talked to Dr. Steve Turley. I count him as an ally in the overall scheme of things, you know? So, I've had my difficult run-ins with the Schizo guys, but I mean, who is like a kind of intelligent Schizo? James Dyer? James Dyer, is he intelligent? Kind of. Broadly speaking, though, I'd say, well, he's probably on the same side as me when it comes to a lot of things, right? Broadly speaking, we're on the same side, so, you know. I wanted to ask your views about the role of women in the right, particularly with regard to containment. I think there is a view count and a financial incentive for right-wing women who young and are even a 5 out of 10 to show their faces and are not anonymous. I think this is also related to a pipeline to more mainstream platforms, such as Unheard. Who is it for? By the way, I'm going to come back to Unheard in a second because I've got a rant, friends, and I'm something I'm pissed off about with Unheard. But anyway, I'll come back to that. NatCon, the critic, they want women for the same reasons of increasing male engagement and also probably legitimacy within the liberal paradigm. Also, obviously, social validity is massive for the individual woman. Scrump and Evelyn have obviously spoken quite a bit about Mary Harrington, who does write interesting content quite a bit. I still have time for, but nonetheless, as you demonstrated, when push comes to shove, she stands with Israel and the gay. Likewise, Alex Kashuda is another one who I listened to a lot a few years ago and helped me discover a lot of interesting guys. I mean, I have spoken to Alex Kashuda. Some people find me through her. And she wrote on the back of Prophets of Doom. So I always got time for Alex K. I am still friendly with Mary Harrington. We talk on Twitter all the time. These days, so I'm not having a go at any individual people, is what I'm trying to say. These days, though, have been having a few NatCons, is very concerned about misogyny on the right. And it seems to be more aligned with Hanania level takes. My view on this esoteric Elder Man, unfortunately, is that I just don't think it matters. Yes, women turning up in spaces gives social validity, and it makes the scene look more hip and happening, right? This is a point that Ed Dutton made recently on his Substack, where he talked about, for example, women turning up at the Witan now, okay? This makes it seem like something interesting is going on, because women are a form of what Robert Cialdini would call social proof. Persuasion, friends, utilize those skills. See, this is basically one of the secrets behind my revamp, by the way. All of this influence stuff I learned, I'm just basically putting it into practice. It was a secret card I had up my sleeve. My honest view is that their actual views matter a lot less than all of that. It's given too much time and attention, in my view. How can I put this nicely? There's no kind way of putting it, really. I just don't think that... how can I put this in a way that's not going to make me seem like a raging... basically, a lot of women's views on things are a form of self-justification for whatever they're feeling in at a given moment in time, right? And a lot of it, almost all of it, is a post hoc justification for their own life's choices. In my experience, women, even in political spaces, find it very difficult to get out of the way of themselves and to see something purely in the abstract, or to see something with the personal, by which I mean their own personal lives, removed from the equation, i.e. to give a systems level analysis which does not foreground their own quote-unquote lived experience, okay? Now, there are some exceptions to this, of course. You can think of exceptions in your own time, but 9 times out of 10, there's a huge amount of post hoc self-justification going on, when it comes to female discourse. And my view is that, well, this is just what women do, right? There's no point railing against that, because you might as well be asking a lion to become a vegetarian. A lion is not going to be a vegetarian. A lion likes to eat fucking meat, okay? Well, in the exact same way, women are just going to do this at all times and all places. On my little daily shorts videos, I don't know if they've aired yet, these particular ones, but I have a whole spate of ones where I talk about these sorts of issues, like only little one minute hits that I give every day. But I talk about, how to think about and deal with the women in your life and all of this sort of thing. And basically, most of the issues come from not seeing, basically thinking that women are just like you, and they think like you, and they relate to politics in the same way that you do. The relationship between women and the truth is completely different between us and the truth. Completely different. When I talk about the truth, I'm trying to make an objective analysis based on available information and facts. When they just have a different relationship with the truth, I'll just put it that way. I'm not going to say that they're all liars, right? I'm just saying they have a different relationship with it that is always subjective and always from their own point of view and is always self-justifying. And it's true from the point of view of their own lived experience, okay? In a way, there's a great truth to the feminist critique of science as being an inherently patriarchal form. That's true. The woke are more correct than the mainstream on that matter. And that is why all feminists since the start of feminism have pretty much had a massive issue with capital S science. It's why they rail against evolution. It's why they rail against, it's why you find feminists arguing for black voodoo physics and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, that's just my view. And if you want to call it, all sorts of epithets, I don't really care. Expecting a woman to think and reason and systematize like a man, whether it's in politics or not, you're asking for a hiding to nothing. You are never going to get women to do that way, to think in that way. So what is the utility then? How can you mitigate against this, basically? Well, I mean, realistically, you cannot keep women out of spaces. It's against the law in this day and age, right? If you started trying to make men's only spaces, then you give the managerial state a way in. So I would not recommend trying to kind of gatekeep against women in that sense, okay? What I would say is just if you take what I've said on board, you can kind of welcome them in, but you just have this attitude basically that you know, they're not gonna not be women. I'll just put it that way. They're not gonna not be women. And if you drop that expectation, and if they drop that expectation and you allow them to be themselves, then I think a lot of these issues go away. So many of these issues come from the false equivalence, the false equality that everybody puts on it, right? This is why I have a lot less time for kind of people complaining, young men complaining about how things are not fair and so on. Listen, things are never fair between men and women. They're never fair, right? Like if you're in a relationship with a woman, you may have this kind of quid pro quo attitude where you think, well, listen, I've been good, quote unquote good, for the past like 6 months. And she's still not fucking happy. You know, how about you do something for me for a change? But women just don't think like that. They just don't think in that transactional way. They think in a kind of feeling in the moment way, right? So if in the moment a woman is feeling moody for some reason, or she's feeling like she doesn't like you at the moment, that is what she'll express. And your track record of the past 6 months won't count for anything, because it's not a transactional thing. It's an in-the-moment thing. Completely different way of processing the entire world. So results, track record, you know, what you did last week, being a good guy, you know, past performance, none of it counts for anything in the woman's world, because it's always what she's feeling in the moment. And it's not just in the personal space that is true. That is also true at work. That is also true in the political space. That is true in every space, because that is how women relate to the world. Different species, like I said, like a lion eats meat. A woman is always a kind of perfect presentist in that sense. That's just the truth. I don't know if you want to call it names or whatever, it's just true. So anyway, let me get on to my unheard rant now, because I saw the worst headline ever in Unheard the other day from very subversive character who some people consider a friend. I don't consider a friend for reasons I'll mention in a second. Let me see if I can find this story. oh, here we are. Here we are. I have to. So I'll pull this up. Let me just share my screen here. So this is by Cream U Requel and Unheard. Italy's surrogacy plan undermines family values. Okay. Now this is the story that Giorgia Meloni, for the first time in her stupid traitory life, has actually done something based. In Italy, Meloni has banned gay men from adopting. Right? she has banned gay men from adopting children. And Creemew, in unheard, who is it for? Immediately comes out with, this is a, right, so Maloney banning gay men from adopting children is undermining family values. I tell you what, Creemew, there's your high verbal IQ coming out again, isn't it? So if anybody remembers this character, when I wrote my infamous, no, famous or infamous, depending on who you are, article showing that the data that claims that Jewish IQ is 1.5 standard deviations above white IQ average, right? In America, that the data is based on tiny sample sizes, and in many cases is over 40 years old, and it does not kind of conform to any of the standards of random sampling, sample sizes, etc., that you'd expect. Okay, when I wrote that article, this fellow Creemew went absolutely apeshit, and for a period of about 3 months, basically spammed Twitter with article and data, and like he really, really went to town trying to disprove what I had said in this article. All of it unconvincing, all of it rubbish, all of it kind of Gish Gallop nonsense. You know, it was a better effort than Steve Saylor pointing to Oppenheimer and saying, oh, there's your evidence. The movie Oppenheimer, by the way. Oh, great. Thanks, Noticer-in-Chief Steve Saylor, right? But anyway, this character gave it a much bigger effort. But then it transpired, basically, that this fellow has particular interest in a certain country in the Middle East, let's just say, and spent a huge amount of time. People kind of got the screen grabs of him basically, like, basically showing that he has a partial, he's not doing proper science. He has a really motivated reason to try to get this conclusion that the IQ is higher. And this came about when people pointed out the mathematics results of Israel. And, you know, he basically said in one of his replies, oh, well, you know, we got to do what we can for God's people or something like this. Basically, like, oh, it's really important to try to prove that we're top of this league, even if the numbers don't say it, you know? Anyway, so that showed me that this guy is not really the kind of neutral scientist that he claims he is. And I don't really care who I piss off saying that. I've said it to their faces, and I will do so again, because I am interested in the truth, not clout, not social capital, not power, not any of these things. Just the truth, and the truth is the data is not there, Creemew. But anyway, here we find him in a different context, saying that Italy is undermining family values by banning gay men from adopting. One of the shittest takes I have ever seen anywhere in Unheard, Who Is It For? And it gave me the idea, basically, of coming up with some more articles that Unheard could publish. Harrington, if you're listening, maybe you could submit this to your editor next time. The case for smearing shit all over the walls. Actually, poison is good for you. Here's why. The hidden benefits of gay race communism by Creemew. Fucking Unheard. I hate Unheard. I tell you what, if Harrington had any sense, she'd leave that pathetic organization and just go it alone. You know, she'd probably make more money as well. What does she need it for? Anyway, let's carry on. Let's carry on. If you wanted, you know, I just don't like these people, and I don't really care who I piss off, who, you know, who says what. I'm interested in true things, and, you know, arguing that the data is there when it's not there is dishonest. Doing it for a partial reason is dishonest, and printing in Unheard that you think banning gay men from adoption is undermining family values is the dictionary definition of subversive. So anyway, let me carry on. with some other super chats. So, Ratface says, "Capitalism ho." Thank you very much, Ratface. That's a blast from the past, isn't it? I got a little bit ranty there, but let me just, I'm not going to apologize for getting angry at people who are just basic charlatans, you know, weaseling into these spaces, spreading lies, basically. Coney says, "Have you ever looked into Gerard Wallop, 9th Earl of Portsmouth, aka Lord Lymington? He was a pro-Axis British aristocrat who was instrumental in the early development of the organic movement." No, I've not heard of him, Coney. I've not heard of him. Spasticus Autisticus says, "I am pleased with the news presented at the shareholder meeting, AA. You have the full confidence of the board." Full backing of the board, indeed. Coney says, "The Twitter posts about leftists having a hunter-gatherer mindset, meaning they can't understand storing values of worth, long time horizons, high time preference, was quite interesting." Yeah, I think there's some truth to it. But like I said, I also think that leftists hate, you know, working class, dull, unemployed. You know, if they're of the wrong race, the leftist hates them with equal vigor. In fact, the most hatred you see from the left is actually towards the people who are at the lowest end of the social hierarchy scale. People who have nothing, basically. They really, really have special vehement hatred of them, especially in this country. I've always thought that part of the racial animus is also a class thing. It's also a middle class hatred of the working class as well. And I wish it, I wish those things were more kind of divisible, but they're not. And it really comes out strongly. You'll notice it. It's why, for example, you know, the, it's like the difference between how Douglas Murray gets treated and how Tommy Robinson gets treated, as one example, right? Coney says, "Could you expand more on your tweet? Your quest is more important than her." I agree with this, by the way, but I think its significance is understated. Yes, Coney, I can. Man's highest purpose is his mission, is his quest, okay? Not his woman. Now, this may fly in the face of all sorts of things that you're told. And you may think, oh, well, actually, I live for my relationship. Actually, I live for my marriage. Actually, I live for my family or whatever. Okay. But the fact of the matter is that you go back and you read, let's say, the typical chivalric romance narrative. Okay. And there's that scene where the knight is about to set off and his wife is crying and saying, "Don't go, Sir La-di-da, okay? Don't go. Stay here with me." Now imagine if the knight said, "All right, I'll stay here with you. I'm not going to go and fulfill my quest. I'm going to stay here with you." Do you think the crying wife would respect him more or less if he did that? Because I guarantee you, she, even though she's crying, she wants him to go and show that he is focused on his higher purpose. He is focused on his higher purpose. This is the classical definition of masculine self-actualization, if you want to put it that way. You can go back to the classics. You can read Shakespeare. You can read Evola. You can read any number of other books. Being a man is all about your highest purpose, whatever that happens to be. Okay. Woman's highest purpose is devotional. Devotional. Okay. She will become devoted to something, whether it's her children or her husband or to the church. This is like a nun, for example, can be devoted to those sorts of things. She literally marries the church, for example. But a man's highest purpose is his mission. So this is what I was talking about. And I think that too many men confuse these two things. And they start thinking that their highest purpose is pleasing their wife. But if you make pleasing your wife your highest purpose, she will actually hate you and start to resent you over time. She will respect you a lot more, and she'll be more attracted to you if you keep your mission as your highest purpose. And your wife or your girlfriend or any other woman in your life will test that. She'll constantly try to knock you off, like the damsel. Please don't go, Sir Galahad. Please don't go. It's a test. Actually, she wants you to go. But she'll do all of her little tricks to try to stop. She won't even be conscious of doing that. But you have to keep it in mind. Son of Hester says, interesting to hear Tim talk about this. And I'll tell you, and I can say this because I'm a man of 42 at this point, with more experience in these affairs than I care to admit, including, you know, long relationship I had, where I made all of these mistakes. I've made all of these mistakes at one point or another, as have we all. It's nobody teaches you this shit, which is why I'm saying it. I'm trying to say it so that, I mean, if I had a bloke tell me that when I was 18, it would have been, you know, a lot. You know, I would have appreciated it. Now, I will say, in fairness to my old man, he didn't exactly say that. My dad would always say, "No, son, you should be as the butterfly. You go from flower to flower." So he always said that. Okay, so he was. It was slightly different advice from him, but I understood that he was trying to say, like, don't make one person the center of your being type thing. I want to put the most charitable spin on it, you know. But really, this is something that you'll come to learn over time. And I really believe that. That's not to say don't love your wife or don't love your woman or whatever. It's just to keep in mind that your sense of yourself will diminish if you don't keep that highest purpose in mind. And she will sense that something is lost in you. Something in your core masculinity has been diminished. Son of Hester says, interesting to hear Tim talk about this. He's driven away costers and assistants over the years. Thoughts on CEO types who can't delegate, let go? Well, I think with Tim, is the problem with Tim is that he's not a CEO, he's talent. Tim is talent, not management, but he is being forced into doing a management function, and really he needs to outsource that to somebody else. He's just ill-suited to it. History is full of people who are very good at one thing, but they can't do the other thing, right? I mentioned Walt Disney earlier on. Walt Disney was an artist. He was a creative genius, right? But if you know the story of Disney, he had a brother who basically covered the business side of Disney. I think his brother was called Roy. If Walt Disney didn't have Roy, he would probably still have been penniless. He was an artist, right? He was not a business guy. He was an artist. So he needed somebody like Roy to rein him in, to put a structure around it, to do all of those things that were necessary to keep, you know, to make an actual successful business. I'm not going to have a go at Tim for not having that skill set, because I think he was pretty honest about that in the rant that he gave before he started the self-indulgent part of it, you know. Horatio, was it Roy Disney? Yeah, I was just making sure I got the name right. I thought it was Roy, yeah. Horatio Nelson says, my poor old mother called last night complaining that Tim's show was offline. Ha ha. Linked her to your channel and Trump's appearance and Undertaker's podcast instead. Tim effing sucks. Well, Horatio Nelson's mother, if you did tune in, I apologise for the part where I got a bit ranty. I don't always get ranty. I try to be on my best behaviour, especially for those older women who like to listen in, and there are plenty of them. There's always been a coterie of wine aunts and grandmothers and so on who listen in. And occasionally my own mother listens in, so I try to not be too sweary or too ranty. But occasionally emotion gets the better of me. All right, Mrs. Nelson. James Coleman says, so why do you think he did it? Well, the arch cynic would say that Tim Pool did this for attention, that he's just a kind of drama queen and he's trying to max out clicks and all of that. I don't really think he had any of that in mind. I think he's emotionally immature and felt the need to kind of air his dirty linen in public, basically. Maximus Aquilius says, I recently rewatched BBC's dinosaur documentary, Walking with Dinosaurs, from 1999. There's a deep melancholy embedded throughout the series. Can't help but wonder if the decline of the UK had an effect on the producers. Well, people would have to check that out again. I remember that being on. It was a long time. It was 25 years ago now. Bloody hell. Yeah, that was a big deal, the Walking with Dinosaurs. It was a huge deal. Negro Narcy says, I discovered this channel close to the end of season one of Unpopular Opinions. How? Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics audiobook on YouTube. Well, I never published Basic Economics as an audiobook, but are you saying that on the sidebar I came up when you were listening to Thomas Sowell, Negro Narcy? That was probably how. I have a video coming up, by the way, where I want to take on, I mean, I haven't made it yet. It's just an embryo. And I don't know if it's going to be a Monday video or a Wednesday video. But Thomas Sowell is very committed to this narrative that markets brought people in New York and Chicago together. That Polish people, Italians, Jews, and so on, hated each other. At some point in history, in the late 19th century, the early 20th century, lived in segregated communities, but over decades of going to each other's corner stalls and delis and so on and so forth, begrudgingly kind of started to live in harmony. He tells this story in Basic Economics in about like five of his books. He repeats it over and over again. I want to subject that narrative that Sowell gives us to scrutiny, because New York and Chicago are empirically and objectively the two most segregated cities in the world. The two most segregated cities in the world. And I discovered that apparently there was a civil rights loophole that excluded, gave a Schmittian exception to New York and Chicago and a couple of other northern towns from segregated schools. So they still have school segregation in those places as well. I couldn't believe it. Turns out, if you're the Schmitty exception, you get all the exceptions. Maybe that's that high verbal IQ, eh? Crimew. Sergeant Hoddle says, I'm from the school of doom, but the Joker 2 movie, massively flopping with the most popular Batman slop rogue gallery character, has really made me feel maybe we are back. This is huge, in my opinion. I expected the Marvels and Madame Well to flop. No one knows them, and they're women. The truth of the matter is, Sergeant Hoddle, nobody's watching movies anymore. Nobody, like the whole movie industry is basically, they've basically pissed up the wall so much of their cultural capital. At a time when the pressures on the movie industry, that is from the internet, from streaming services, and from YouTube and social media, basically, are very great. And, you know, I'm doing this Hammer Horror retrospective next week, and I'm going to be talking about the history of the studios. One of the things that they struggled with is when there was a new raft of horror movies in the 70s, The Exorcist and some of the slasher movies, Halloween and all that sort of stuff, Black Christmas. You know, there was a new spate of horror movies. Suddenly Hammer starts to look a bit old-fashioned and a bit creaky, right? So when they first burst on the scene with Dracula in 1958 and Curse of Frankenstein in 1957, they were fresh, they were new, they were innovative. By 1974, 73, they were starting to look like creaky and old-fashioned, okay? Even within the purview of British cinema, Ever Studios, Amicus and what are they called? Tygon. Some of the other studios were starting to do more innovative stuff, right? So, and on top of that, American money was pulling out of Britain at that time. There's a huge amount of American money in Hammer Studios. And in the early 70s, there was a downturn in the entire movie industry due to the advent of television and mainly television showing films for free to air TV, right? Well, if you think about it, that's basically giving away your product for free on the small screen, and you don't have to contend with people eating popcorn and trying to get a good seat and all the rest of it, right? So, you know, cinema as a whole faced a massive downturn in the early 70s, which hit Hammer hard. So the combination of So basically what they needed to do to stay in business at that time was to try to innovate in a way that kept them relevant, okay? Where am I going with this? At the moment, the movie industry is facing as great a challenge as they were in the early 70s when you had all of those challenges I just talked about. So they really need to be trying to really show that there's a reason to watch them as opposed to watching me, for example, or watching Tim Pool, or not watching anything at all, right? That there's a real... And they failed, haven't they? Woke basically has been a massive problem for them. And Joker 2 is just emblematic of that longer-term trend. And they've lost their position. And everybody thinks these companies are too big to go out of business. But bigger fish have fallen in the past. If you have a look at the big seven studios back in the day, they used to, in fact, it was the big eight. I think they called it the big five and the little three back in the classic studio period. Have a look how many of those companies are still going in their original form. I mean, MGM was bought by Amazon, for example. Amazon didn't get big making movies. Amazon got big selling stuff at a low price point to deliver to your door. They weren't movie people, right? So MGM couldn't stay in business, as one example, right? Basically, I mean, United Artists are no longer all of the big studios suffered through really difficult periods. And that happened fairly recently. I think MGM went bust in 2010, if I had to guess. Daniel Hall says, I always loved Hammer and Amicus double features. Despite having the same production styles, they had their own speciality. Hammer did the gothic period horror. Amicus contemporized the weird and the strange tale. Well, my understanding is that Amicus were famous really for their anthology films. There are portmanteau horrors where you've got five different stories in one film. And they tended to be more contemporary, like you said. Hammer specialized in gothic horror, really. And Amicus are a bit later than Hammer, though. Hammer's big period was the mid to late 50s. Amicus, I think, comes along a little bit later. Don't quote me on that, though, but their famous stuff happens in the 60s and the early 70s. And I'll always say it, Charlotte Rampling in Asylum is fit. Spasticus Autisticus says, Slopmonger in chief, Tim Pool, can no longer lift a spoonful of slop to his mouth. No, he needs a nanny to feed it to him as he sits incapable in a high chair with a bib, and he may later regurgitate it through a trough to be lapped up by adoring fans. One thing I will say about Tim Pool is that, I mean, his numbers are not that good on his channel, on his main channel. I was looking at them the other day. I was thinking, some of these videos do worse than mine. Okay, I mean, I'm just coming up to 100,000 subs. He's a 1 million plus. I don't know how many subs he's got, but it's over a million, right? He should be caning me, but his figures are comparable. You know, if my videos, the Friday ones, as you saw, you know, a bad one would be like 8,000, you know, let's say middling would be like 12 to 15, something like that. Or if it's a hit for me, it'd be like 30, 40, up to 50,000, something like that. Well, a lot of Tim Pools don't do that. A lot of Tim Pools are either comparable or worse than mine, which I find really surprising, to be honest. So maybe something is going wrong there. Maybe something is going wrong. But yeah, I mean, somebody's saying his other channel is the one that does big numbers. Well, the thing is, what I'm saying is, you have to expect him to do good numbers. He's Tim Pool, for God's sake, right? He is the arch grandmaster of the School of Slop. So, you know, for his main channel to be comparable with mine means that things aren't going as well as they could be for him. Yeah, I'm sure he'll come back, though. He's a master at the... Tim Pool is the absolute master of algorithm. So let's never count out somebody like that. Blue Wizrobe says, women are like Obi-Wan Kenobi. What they say is true from a certain point of view. Absolutely, Blue Wizrobe. And what I would say is that usually there'll be the grain of something true or wise there in what a woman is trying to tell you. There'll be the grain of something. You just have to kind of tease it out sometimes, or you have to get your head around it, which requires, I would say, a lot of stoicism on your part, not reacting, not arguing as if they were a bloke, taking it on board, etc. There's no point doing the back and forth thing, because also they don't like the sparring. Men use arguments as a kind of proxy for dueling, right? Dueling back and forth with rapiers. You know, I hit you with these facts, you come back with these facts, I come back with my facts. And it's kind of like a sword fight, right? Women don't want a sword fight. They don't want a sword fight. They don't kind of get any pleasure from it in that same way. So Sheep Apocringe says, hello, it's me, Sheep Apocringe. How is everybody doing? Hi, Sheep. Blue Wizrobe says, any comment on Trump's McDonald's photo op? Yes, Blue Wizrobe. It is the best bit of campaigning he has done ever. I may make a video on it, rank opportunistic video, but I feel like I'm probably not going to have time, or I don't want to. But yeah, it is one of the best bits of campaigning I've ever seen from anybody. It's an absolute stone-cold knockout, and the leftists who are trying to paint it as a fail in some way are coping hard. I've been saying from the start, Kamala Harris is a jobber. Trump on the poly markets is over 60%. Kamala is under 35%. Is AA always right, or is AA always right? Just type in the chat, AA is always right. And I'm going to do Hulk Hogan cup ears. I'm doing Hulk Hogan cup ears. And I'm doing Hulk Hogan pose downs. Crowd is roaring. That's basically what's happening right now. Sam 153 says, it looks like office hours will fall on November 5th on election day. Are you going to have a Kamala Harris jobber special? Cheers. Well, thank you very much, Sam 153. It means so much. No. And the reason is that I have agreed to be on some election day coverage that day in person, live and in color. So yeah, you can guess where, because I've been on with them before. Blue Wizrobe says, Sir La-di-da, not so brave as Sir Lancelot, who personally wet himself at the Battle of La-La-Land Hill. or brave Sir Robin, of course, with his coconuts. BVB09 says, AA, would you make videos or streams on masculinity relationship pickup for younger men? Last week you said some profound things and I found it useful. Well, BVB, it's not really my kind of forte. Look out for my daily shorts, because I've got a whole spate of little one-minuters. On my based books, I talked through some of the sources for these basic ideas. Ultimately, it goes back to Evola's Eros and Love book. I forget what the name of that is. Eros and the Mysteries of Love, I think it's called, which is the more esoteric version. There's also a book by David Dada called The Way of the Superior Man. Now, there's a lot of weird shit in that book, and he writes it from a kind of progressive or kind of liberal point of view. He's like very kind of modern, and there's something about Dada that might rub some people up the wrong way. But get past all of that. Put it to the back of your mind if you can. Get to those middle sections on the core of the book when he's dealing with women. And Dada, I'm telling you, is just serving straight up Avolian prognoses on the solar masculine and the lunar feminine, without doubt. So those would be the first two places to start, is that Dada book and Evola's. I mean, there are others as well. It's less on the pickup side, though. I'm not saying do these things and women will fall over you, or I'm also not even trying to like get you to have like sex or anything like that. Dada is a bit strange. Like, he's always talking about like penetrating your woman and stuff like that, sort of that, all that sort of stuff. I'm kind of less interested in that side of it. Maybe I'm just too old and jaded or gay or something, I don't know. But I find myself not so interested in all of those sorts of things. I'm much more interested in just the nuts and bolts, how to deal with the one-on-one interaction. And it's very useful for that sort of stuff. But it does get a bit weird. It does get... And to be fair, Evola gets a bit all kind of sex magic and stuff at some points as well. I'm less interested in the kind of hardcore sex element. And to pick up stuff, I mean, really, when it comes to picking up, my only advice is have as much of a life as possible, have a social life. If you go on dating sites, right, don't post a selfie. Don't post something that you've taken on your own in your room. Post pictures when you're in a situation out in the pub with your mates. Have a mate in the picture with you. Make it look like you're kind of a hip and happening guy. Because women don't like a loser, and they'll pick up on loser vibes. So you need to make it look like, I mean, not even make it look like, you need to not be a loser. And that is the main thing that will, quote unquote, pick up. You know, that's the best advice I can give on that. I don't want to hear all the excuses and the, oh, but we live in a society that makes divorce so easy. And I understand all of that. Yes, we all live in the real world. I face all of those constraints too. There's all sorts of things that we can't do that we used to be able to do as men, right? Still, it doesn't matter. Still, women look for the same things in men. Still, men have to ultimately take it upon themselves to make themselves the best they can possibly be. Blue Wizrobe says, Tim Pool was at his best when he was on the ground, old school journalism. The minute he stopped doing that, he stopped being interesting. Yeah, I agree. Torgo the White says, congratulations on almost 100K. Just 800 more. Let's go. A little bit worried about that because I always said that 100K is worth a celebration. Now it's actually coming. I'm thinking, shit, that means I actually have to do a party or something. I hate parties. I hate celebrations. But when that comes, we'll have to figure something out. Just so happens next week, I'm exceptionally busy and there's not going to be an office hours next week, friends. I can tell you that now. And the reason is, well, there's a family matter that I must attend to next week. I'll just put it that way. There's definitely not going to be a show next Tuesday. I can tell you that for sure. Whether we'll do a party stream, that remains to be seen. Let's play that by ear. All right. I think that's it for Super Chats. Yep. When is the Shakespeare course releasing? Well, Brent, I've had a number of setbacks on Shakespeare. One was the whole fact of the revamp. Second thing was this family matter that I don't want to really go into, but something that is disruptive, let's just say. And the third thing is me getting this cold in the past week or so. All of these things have kind of put me back a bit. But I signed a book contract for the 1st of December, which means it will be finished by the 1st of December, no matter what, because I have to get that book contract in. And it's one thing I always do, I make my deadlines. Unlike 98% of all other academics who always beg off and always miss their deadlines. Not me. I deliver on time. I get it done. Why, though? Did it do me any good professionally? No, because academia is a line of work that does not reward merit. Doesn't reward merit, does it, Jordan? Where is he? Oh, moment's gone now. Where's he gone?
Merit, pure merit, such merit, merit, such merit, merit, such merit, merit, such.
All right. Bye, everyone. Get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.